Aha, I'm on. Okay. Hello. How are you all? Can you hear me in the back? No. How about now? Does that work? Maybe if I wouldn't whisper, you'd be able to hear me. Okay. For those of you who are interested in human development and family studies, like the majors, or people doing the major concentration, sometimes the question comes up, what can I do with this? And we've scheduled a session, courtesy of the Career Development Services, on the 28th at 6 in Living Learning, with food. Well, refreshments. I don't know what they mean by refreshments. I didn't check, but I will. So you're all invited. You're all welcome. There will be faculty, and more importantly, there will be alumni who are doing interesting things, most of them local, because we can't pay their expenses. So you're all invited. Come and see what other people have done with it. And there'll also be time to talk about graduate school, how to find jobs, internships, things of that sort. Questions? Housekeeping stuff, Talia? No? Okay. Exercise ones are here if you haven't picked yours up yet. Exercise twos are coming in today, because they're due today. Thank you. And the question is, did you have questions about assignment two? What did you discover, or what did you have problems with as you were working on it? Problems with the concept of dyads? Things you discovered as you were writing it? Easy concept. It was easy to find dyads, right? And you didn't have any questions. It's going to be so easy to grade. How many of you made the mistake of saying that you have primary dyad with your parents? You have two primary dyads, one with each parent. It's okay.
I said I had with my mother.
You had with your mother, okay. You didn't say parents. Okay. You guys are smart. Okay. I like that. They will be easy to grade. You all figured out that it can be both a primary and a joint activity dyad at the same time. It can be an observational dyad at times, but still primary. And as we talk about family and family changes and relationships in them, one of the things that we'll be doing is asserting probably that most of your dyadic relationships within your family are primary. The issue is whether or not the people are available for activities, how you do joint activities with somebody who's not present, what kinds of activities, whether it's a developmental dyad as well as a primary dyad, the developmental dyad being the highest level in Bronfenbrenner's thinking. Okay, anything else come up? Difficulty with reciprocity? Power? Tiffany. Right. The difficulty keeping those, particularly the affect, is usually not a problem. But the reciprocity and power clearly are related concepts. So it's sometimes difficult, as you're describing a relationship, to figure out whether you're talking about reciprocity in it or power in it, and in fact you may at the same time be talking about both or the combination of them. But they can conceptually be separated, but they also tend to be confounded as we think about real relationships. Did you have a specific example you wanted to share that was... Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about who initiates, that's primarily reciprocity. If you both initiate activities and you do things that are initiated by both, that's primarily focusing on the reciprocity. It does typically indicate that there is equal power. Sometimes you'll see a high degree of reciprocity where each person initiates, but one person really has much more power in other ways than the other. So you can look for the activities, which are typically indicators of the reciprocity, and then you can look at the results of those activities, which are more indicative of the power in them. But they clearly overlap. Any other questions or issues that came up? Things you discovered in writing it? Nope. Okay. Moving beyond that, then. Did any of you tackle the microsystem part? Okay. How was that? Okay, so in one microsystem, just looking at one setting, you may play several roles. Yeah, and that's typical. And were you able to define when it is they change, when you move from one role to the other, to another?
No, that was where I had the problem. Okay. It was hard to understand what my role was in that specific microsystem.
Okay. So it raises questions for you in that particular setting, what your role is, and let me just speculate. This is pop psych, so don't take it anyplace. But if you're having difficulty figuring out when you're in which role, then there may be something about the pattern of activities and relations that is ambiguous, and it may be creating some difficulty in that setting because you're not clear what your role is at different times. When the roles are clear and well defined, then you know, for example, that the pattern is your role changes when somebody else comes into that setting who plays a different role because your roles are complementary. And it's clear, and you can feel the shift, and you know then that the activities are going to change. And that's a different kind of microsystem. It's one with clear roles, clearly defined, and a predictable pattern. And what you were trying to describe, it sounds like, is one where it's not quite clear and therefore perhaps a little confusing and a little bit unpredictable. And that's an important distinction. It's an important thing to know about a setting and a microsystem, that the microsystem may in fact not be as clearly defined as it could be, and the roles are ambiguous. And that may make it harder to adapt to that role, particularly if you come into it new because you can't figure out what's going on. The clearer and more predictable the pattern of role relationships and activities is, the more predictable that pattern is, the easier it is to figure out what your role is and when to play it and to adapt to the setting. When things are unpredictable, we stay up in the air longer and our development is challenged. And our performance is challenged. Good. Other experiences with the microsystem?
Well,
But it sounds like you understand the setting and the pattern in it. It's just a complex pattern. It's a restaurant. You have a role, but there are lots of different people who come in with whom you have other relationships. So it's not every customer comes in and has the same relationship with you. I'm thinking about a contrasting microsystem that somebody described a couple of years ago of being the counterperson at Wendy's. And you're the counterperson at Wendy's, and you do it for a three-hour shift, I think it was, and everybody who comes through the line, you have the same role, you go through the same routine, it's very repetitive, and therefore very boring, because it allows no creativity. And if somebody comes in that you know, because your supervisor is there, you can't even engage in the idle chit-chat, because you got to do it the Wendy's way. It sounds like yours is much more fun, perhaps frustrating at times, but much more complex to try to describe. So let me guess that you understand it, the roles and the relationships and the activities, but because it's complex, it's hard to describe. Is that where the challenge was?
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And in any interesting setting, well, not any, in lots of settings, the microsystem is so complex that when you start trying to describe it, you run into that challenge. And we expect that it's typical. And I have myself, believe it or not, actually on occasion tried to write answers to these exercises. It's an interesting thing to try to do. When you ask a question on an exam or you give an assignment, I know faculty who don't do it, and I don't want to be that, so I occasionally try to answer my own questions. That's how I find out, A, it's a stupid question, or it's a complex question, or I don't know anything. I'm sometimes not sure which I'm learning. But in this particular case, the idea of describing the pattern is very quickly overwhelming, and it's hard to do in a short instance. And I want to comment more on that in a minute, very specifically. But other experiences writing about the microsystem? How many of you did it again? You win, dead on. I asked Talia to estimate how many of you would. She said about 10%, which would be about 12 of you, and it looks like you may be right about that. Okay, let me talk about, briefly, the issue of describing a system. This course raises several issues. One is, how do you think transactionally when you've got two people engaging in a transaction? How do you describe the relationship? You describe the people and then you describe the relationship. And it's a challenge to have language for describing the relationship. Bronfenbrenner helps us by saying, focus on the power of the affect and the reciprocity. The course also gives us a challenge in that when you think about a system, it's very difficult to describe some systems, and particularly human systems, when you sit down to write a description. Because human systems, because they are systems, don't have a beginning and an ending point. And the problem that we have in writing is a problem that Gutenberg, the inventor of the printing press, developer of the printing press, Gutenberg handed us this terrible problem, which is that we all expect to read. And when we learn to talk, we learn to talk in narrative. We learn to tell stories. And our papers, we're told in high school, are supposed to be stories. They have a beginning point, a thesis. And then they develop the story of that, and then they have a conclusion. And the model that we have is linear. It's linear that goes from step 1 to step 2 to step 2 to 3 to 4 to 5, beginning to end. When you try to describe a pattern of roles, relationships, and activities, where do you start? And how do you describe it when our language is linear? You have to start at the beginning of the page and you go to the end of the essay. And the challenge, and I want to raise your awareness of it, because sometimes it's extremely frustrating when you're trying to describe something that is all connected. You have to pick a place to start talking about it, and then you have to figure out which direction you're going in the description. And there may not be a right place to start. There may not be a right direction to go. There is no true 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 narrative. And so if you think about your writing and thinking as having to be linear, you'll be frustrated. What I'm doing is giving you permission to be a little frustrated, to recognize it, and just jump in wherever you are and wherever you want to start, and then make sure you cover all of the pieces and components after that and talk about how they're related to each other. That's what's necessary in a system. You figure out, where can I start that makes sense? But it may not be the only place to start. And which direction to go may depend on which way you think of going, rather than being the right way to proceed. So there's a tension here. Whenever you're trying to describe a pattern that is reciprocal, mutual, interlocking, systemic, that it's not linear. And that goes with the territory. So enjoy the tension between your desire to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 narratives and the necessity to try to describe patterns which have interlocking components and connections. You can't describe them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 except arbitrarily. You can decide what the numbers are. So enjoy the tension and trust that we will know that tension and know the difficulty of trying to present the details of any kind of system or pattern. Those of you who stick around in Human Development Family Studies will have many opportunities to explore that tension and that frustration. But we share it. It's okay. Okay. The next exercise, which is due a week from today, is about the mesosystem. So let me remind you of what that essay looks like, that exercise. So you'll be thinking about Valentine's Day. This is what you're going to look forward to. Valentine's Day. No Valentines in our mailboxes, but we get your essays. That's why we made them due on Valentine's Day, because we might not get Valentines otherwise. So if you want to, just draw little hearts at the end of your paper, and we'll feel Valentined. Okay, what we're going to talk about today is the mesosystem and the links, the variety of links, and then we'll take a look at the hypotheses that Bronfenbrenner presents. And the mesosystem, and I'll put up the definition in a minute, the mesosystem comprises the connections among the settings that you actually participate in. So as you think about doing this exercise, you'll need to pick 3 of the settings that you actually participate in. Remember that each of those settings has a microsystem in it. But the mesosystem asks you to think about the relationships between the settings. How are those settings connected? So in this exercise, you're going to be thinking about your mesosystem, 3 settings that you participate in, and think about how they relate to each other. How are they linked? And each pair, if you do 3, you'll have 3 pairs of settings. And for each pair, you can talk about the links between them. You are a primary link connecting all of them. That's what defines it as being your mesosystem. You participate in each of those settings. You're the primary link. That defines the mesosystem. But the settings are linked in other ways as well, and that's what we'll be looking at today. And we'll be looking at more than these hypotheses, but I wanted to pick half a dozen or so for you to focus on and think about how they might be represented within your mesosystem. So this is a personal mesosystem, and it's an opportunity to start describing your ecosystem beyond the dyads that you participate in, if you did the first part of the first assignment, or the microsystem in one of your settings. Now we're going to look at how the settings you participate in are connected. Okay. So let's look at these. We'll be looking for you to apply each of these six hypotheses to at least one pair of the settings in your mesosystem. And I think you can probably do that. You may run into difficulties, and that'll give us more to talk about. Okay. The mesosystem comprises the interrelations among two or more settings in which the developing person actively participates. You are the developing person. We're talking about your mesosystem. And this is one of the few places where Bronfenbrenner really got himself wrong. It's always fun when somebody doesn't understand himself. And the problem, as I point out in the book, is that he defines the mesosystem as the relationships among the settings and then gives us examples which aren't. The neighborhood peer group is not a setting. The neighborhood may be, but the peer group is not. Family is not a setting. The household is. Work might be a setting if we talk about where you work, the place where you work. But employment and the work that you do is not a setting. We tend to refer to the place where we work as, well, I'm going to work. And we understand that implies the place where I work, the place where I'm employed. But it's not clear. So Bronfenbrenner said a few years later, I blew that one. So in 1994, he elaborated the definition and corrected it in this way. The mesosystem comprises the linkages and the processes taking place between two or more settings containing the developing person. So he switched from in which you participate to where you are, where you're contained. And then his examples are pointing at the computer screen doesn't do anything, does it, for you? So his examples then are home and school, which clearly are settings, school and the workplace, which clearly are settings. Okay. So in your thinking, what I want to do is reinforce that you think about the settings when you talk about the mesosystem. You have to think about the places. Then you can think about what happens in the places and talk about the microsystem in each one. But when we refer to the mesosystem, we're talking about how they are connected, how the settings are connected. A mesosystem, he says, is a system of the microsystems. And it refers not as much to what goes on in the settings, but how what goes on in a setting relates to what goes on in a different setting. So are the microsystems in the two settings connected to each other, and if so, how? Are the people who participate in one setting the same people that participate in a different setting? Are they supportive of your participation in both or not? Or do they hinder it? And do they have consistent or congruent? Do they agree? Do they have consistent attitudes or views of you? and what you do in the other setting. That would make them supportive of each other, and that would be part of the relationship between the two settings. Okay, let's look at links first. And Bronfenbrenner describes the direct links, and the direct links are the people who participate in both settings. The primary link being the developing person whose mesosystem we are describing, and that person is the primary link. Then there are other people. And these are what Bronfenbrenner calls the indirect linkages between settings. So the primary link is the person that we're talking about, and other people then are intermediate links. So they may be supporting. I'm sorry, I have my overhead out of order because this isn't the one that I want to talk about first. And I don't have the one I want to talk about. Okay? So we'll do it from the book. What I wanted to get to was going from the primary link to supporting links. Supporting links are other people who participate in the same two settings. So they are the people who create a transcontextual dyad with you. So you're in one setting, your roommate in that setting takes the same class with you. Your residence hall room and the classroom are part of your mesosystem. They are also part of your roommate's mesosystem. And because you're in the same two settings together, she is a supplemental link. Okay, you are the primary link. The other person is a supplemental link. And there may in some cases be a number of supplemental links. As you have a group of people who work together, who play together, who live together. And in Bronfenbrenner's terms, what is important about the mesosystem, one of the things that's important about the mesosystem is how many people participate in those settings together. Is it richly connected by having a number of people that you know in more than one setting? And people who know you in more than one setting. Because if your settings are shared with the same people, then you have the opportunity to talk about and reflect about and compare each of the settings. So you can be in the same class and then think about it and talk about it with somebody that you live with who's in the same course and get validation of that or an improved view, understanding of what's going on in the course. If your roommate's not in the same class, is not a transcontextual dyadic member, is not a supplementary link for you, then when you go back to your room, you can talk about the course, and a good roommate may offer you support and ask you questions, but may not be able to directly provide differentiated feedback to you. You can say, well, that's not what I understood the instructor to say. And because she was there, her view has some validity. You have to think about it because she actually heard what you heard, but she interpreted it differently, so now you're going to talk about it, and that may be very helpful in understanding what was going on in the classroom. So the value of having supplemental links is that it gives you the opportunity to understand your ecosystem more validly by having multiple perspectives that you can talk about. Okay? So we have direct links that are primary, you, and the supplemental links, which are also direct, people who go back and forth. Then we can look at the indirect linkages. And I'm sorry not to have the other overhead, but it says what I just said. And in this case, what we're talking about is settings that are actually not in your mesosystem because you don't participate in them, but settings that are indirectly linked to your mesosystem because they're in somebody else's mesosystem. So in this case, we have the first setting, and let's say we have three people who are in that setting. Okay, you're A. That's you. And there's another setting in which you and B both participate. So this one is linked by you, so it has a primary link. It has a supplemental link, B, and that's cool. You go back and forth. And then there may be the third setting in which C and B participate, but you don't. So it is in, this is, these two are in your mesosystem, but the third setting is not, because you don't go there. Okay. But it is indirectly linked to your other settings, indirectly, because somebody that you participate in setting one with is in setting three. So that provides what we will come to call an exosystem setting, and the exosystem setting is indirectly linked to your mesosystem. Okay. So we introduced this here because we need to talk about people who go back and forth and people who know other people that you don't know, and maybe there's D here. And the fact that D exists in the third setting and not in any setting you're in gives you the opportunity to find out about D, to learn about D, because in your other settings, people who do know D directly are likely to talk about D. Okay. So D becomes somebody you're aware of and you can have a great deal of information about, but never actually encounter yourself. But that indirect linkage is important because of the knowledge that you have about that setting. And what will happen eventually is that you will use that, and Bronfenbrenner has a hypothesis about it. D may become important to you because in some other setting, D hires. D hires. Okay. So these two settings are directly linked. You as A want to get into this setting. The fact that you know people who know D give you an entree into the setting where Dee's role is to decide whom she hires. And we play this game all the time. It's the who do you know game. And it makes your potential entry into the fourth setting more likely. Because when you call and say, I'd like to interview for a job, B sent me. And C supported that. Ah, says D. Okay. So I know a little bit about you, and you're activating our indirect links, our indirect network, our second order, our third order network, our old boy network of people who know each other, or our old girl network. and dropping their names is going to get you in the door. Or kill your chances of ever getting a job there, depending on what C and B have told B about you. Now, why is that important? It's important, the indirect linkages are important because they can support your development. In the case of you going into that employment setting, let's assume the employment is going to be good for you, it's what you want to do, it's going to give you money, it's going to pay your rent. The indirect linkages of C and B to you and to D mean that D has knowledge about you, he's more willing, she's more willing, whichever it is more willing to interview you and consider you because of that connection. And because of C and B's connection, you may find out that D has a job available. And if you didn't have those indirect linkages, you might never know. You might never know. You might find out about the job because C comes one day and says, hey, I was talking to D, he's going to hire some more people. Why don't you call? That's intersetting knowledge. It's another kind of linkage. It's communication. That wouldn't happen if you weren't participating in the settings where C was and if C wasn't involved with D. It's important because the more of those connections there are in your mesosystem, the more opportunities for activities and roles and relationships will be open to you. If you have a very limited mesosystem, you participate in a few settings, they're not connected indirectly to each other, you don't know many people, you don't communicate with many people who think well of you, your world is, I won't say sterile, your world is, what would you call it? It's not very well connected. It's sparse. There's not much in it, and it's not very well connected. And that's not good for your development. So Bronfenbrenner is interested in how people's settings get connected to each other and how those connections support our development, how they support increasing or enlarging our mesosystem. In this case, because you can drop C and B's name to D, and because C told you D had a job, you become aware of this setting. You're more motivated because you do know people. It's not a cold call for a job. It's not a fill out an application, I'll put it on the pile with the other 30. It's a phone call from somebody that knows somebody he knows. And it's likely to get you in the door. So people whose settings are connected to each other in those ways help each other. It's helpful, Bronfenbrenner says, if your parents know your teacher. Well, it may be dangerous if your parents know your teacher, but theoretically it can be supportive of your development because in the classroom, the fact that your teacher knows your parents and plays tennis with them someplace else makes it more likely that the teacher is going to pay attention to you. Fact of life. She's going to be thinking about what you say to them when you go home. And she doesn't want to be mean to you. She doesn't want you to misunderstand because of that indirect linkage. So the more people know each other, the more likely they are to be accountable to each other, and the more likely they are to watch out for each other and to engage each other in activities and have positive affect toward them and open opportunities and doors for them, and that's better for your development. And if you take that back, it's why parents need to know the teachers. It's why parents need to be involved in school and communicate with her And it's, to some extent, why teachers should be initiating that, to make sure they know the parents. The parents are much more likely to help the child with the homework if the parents know the teacher. And that's going to be good for the kid's development. If the parents think the teacher is just some weirdo out there who doesn't really care about their kid, then why should they help the kid with homework? But if they know the teacher is going to be checking up on them and the teacher is available to help them with the homework, there's communication in both directions, they're more likely to do it. They're more likely to engage in activities that are going to help the child in school. Okay? You see where this is going? The linkages among the different settings we participate in may support our development. And the more richly linked the settings that we participate in are, the better that is likely to be for our development. It can backfire. There are situations where you would rather people not know who you are. There are situations where having a transcontextual dyad might be bad for you. Your reputation may precede you when you go into a setting, and it may not be all that good. So if you have a bad reputation, if you're related to people that people don't like, if your family's a bunch of crooks and thieves, and that's the connection that everybody knows, that's the knowledge, and everybody knows somebody who's been harmed by your relatives, that may not be good for your development. But assuming that the affect and the reputation and all that are positive, it's going to be good for your development. Okay. Second-order networks are important to us because they make it easier for us to add settings to our mesosystem. They make it easier for us to communicate between settings. It increases the amount of knowledge we may have about other settings, and that makes our world more complex. Other ways that settings can be connected, I've mentioned them, but inter-setting communication. Whenever messages are transmitted from one setting to another, that's inter-setting communication. And not the what did you have for lunch, but when it's intentional. I'm trying to give information about this setting. So UVM and your home, the household from which you applied and where perhaps your parents live, there's communication between us. We send a lot of information home. That's inter-setting communication. We want the home to know what's going on for you here. We want people at home to know what our expectations are. We want them to know what the opportunities are so that they can support your participation in this setting. So they have that information. That's good for you. And probably good for them because it helps them be more realistic. Okay. And there are lots of ways you can do that kind of communication. There's intersetting knowledge which is created by that communication. When information or experience about one setting exists in the other. So, for example, here, D is a primary link, and he's providing information about setting 4 in this setting, and C and perhaps B are bringing that back into setting 1. So there's knowledge being created in setting 1 about setting 4. Hey, I think D is adding more people. There's a job opportunity there. That's inter-setting knowledge. If you don't communicate, if you can't transmit that message, then you don't know what's going on and you miss the opportunity that might be available in that other setting. Okay. It's important that there are multiple ways in which settings can be linked. The more the merrier. Inter-setting knowledge, inter-setting communication, indirect linkage, primary dyads, multiple transcontextual dyads. And for Bronfenbrenner, the question, the issue is how richly connected are the settings in your mesosystem. The more richly they're connected, the better that is for you. And the challenge in exercise 3 is to take pairs of your settings and figure out how many different ways they're linked. Just describe all the different ways. And some of them may be richly linked, complexly linked, and others may not be. Now to the hypotheses about the mesosystem. Bronfenbrenner suggests that what we're going to get out of a setting, what we're going to do developmentally in it, is enhanced if you go into that setting in a transcontextual dyad. In other words, if you're a kid and you go into school, kindergarten, by yourself, without a parent, that's not nearly as good as if you can go into school your first day with your parent and there are three of your best friends from the neighborhood or from preschool who are going into that same class with you. So Bronfenbrenner suggests that at least for a young person, going into a setting that is new to us all by ourselves makes it more difficult for us to enter that setting and to engage in the activities that are going to happen there. Why would that be? Why is it easier?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so less familiarity.
You're taking somebody from a familiar setting and bringing it into a setting.
And because you're taking that person from a familiar setting in with you, or you're going in together, what are you able to do? You're more comfortable because there's a familiar face. That's a very important part of it. You automatically have somebody you're not afraid to talk to. Somebody knows you, and being known in a setting is important. How do you feel when you walk into a setting where you don't know anybody and nobody knows you? Okay, where do I start? If you're a shy person, as many of us are, your entry into that setting may be slow. You may be a little anxious, and your basic need to connect with other people may not be met for quite a while. It won't be met until somebody takes the initiative, and we're much more likely to take the initiative to engage somebody in a conversation if they're familiar and if we're with somebody that we already know. So if we can go together and go up and talk to somebody, I'm likely to have more confidence in doing that if I've got somebody beside me who helps me be comfortable. Tiffany? Yeah. Yeah. You know that there's somebody who's in the same situation, and that's helpful because that begins to define your role. Okay, I'm a newcomer, but so's Charlie, and we've been through a lot of new stuff together, and we know how to do this, so you hang on to me, Charlie, and I'll hang on to you, and we'll do this together. But I know I'm not unique in the setting. And if I know I'm not unique, I'm more able to engage in it. That's the danger. And some of you have already been through that, I suspect. You came here, you came to UVM, you palled around with somebody you went to high school with, you came with your best friend, maybe you even roomed together, and about middle of fall semester you realize, A, you can't stand that person anymore because you're roommates, B, you're spending all your time with people you already know, and you're not enlarging the circle. And that is a problem. It is a danger. And Bronfenbrenner doesn't really quite address that until he gets to hypothesis 37, when he says if you're already really comfortable in your settings, then maybe what you need to do to develop is to jump off into something quite different all by yourself. And that's the, I had an email recently from one of our majors, one of my advisees, who's in Prague, Czechoslovakia. There isn't any Czechoslovakia anymore. It's the Czech Republic. I'm only, 5 years behind in my geography? Well, it was Czechoslovakia for a long time. But I have friends from Slovakia, too, who are telling me, it ain't Czechoslovakia anymore. Stop that. I'll get it eventually. Anyway, she's in Prague. Jumped in. She's having a ball. She was ready for it. Yeah. And she hadn't done that before. It's the study abroad. Okay, this student needs to study abroad because of hypothesis 37. I don't write that in the letter of recommendation for the study abroad program, but that's what's in my mind. This is a student who is perfectly comfortable here. Time for a challenge. They're going to throw her into Prague or Africa or someplace else. Wherever. Needs a new setting. But the danger is that you can depend too much on the person that you go in with. And for Bronfenbrenner, what would be important then is that that dyadic relationship not prevent you from engaging in activities and new relationships which are fundamental to the developmental potential of the new setting. The new setting's developmental potential depends on you being able to extend your activities, create new relationships, play new kinds of roles in it. And if the familiar person you're going in with helps you get started, that's good. If the new person keeps you from engaging, that's bad. So it's what's happening then with the proximal processes that are going on after you've gotten comfortable in the setting. Let me give you a practical example related to these hypotheses. One of my favorite elementary school principals, who's now retired, many years ago, was interested in the fact that so many kindergartners come into school and they have a really rough time. And the kindergarten teachers spend an awful lot of time holding and comforting and, you know, trying to deal with kids who are having a very difficult time the first week, sometimes 2 weeks, and occasionally the first month. And it saps your energy. It takes a lot of teacher time and energy. You don't want to have to do that. And he didn't read Bronfenbrenner, but he did this brilliant thing. I don't know where he got the idea, but it's absolutely brilliant. Schools always have orientation, right? And so their orientation had always been the parents bring the kid to school and the teachers orient the kid to school. And this goes sometimes very badly because you have a kid who's now meeting the stranger. That's the purpose, you meet a stranger, but that's when they start having problems. So they're at orientation and they're bawling their eyes out and they're not paying any attention to what's going on. So he changed it. Orientation is set up in their school so that parents come. They don't bring their kids. Well, if they have to, the kids do childcare down in the other end of the school. The parents meet the teacher. Parents rarely bawl. Well, mothers have been known to cry when they walk into the room that their child is about to be captured in and ripped in timely fashion from the maternal psychological womb as the school begins its process of socializing. Mothers do cry, particularly when their first one or their last one goes off to kindergarten. But in this case, what happens is parents come in, the teacher orients the parents, shows them the room, goes through the day, talks about the appropriate use of the materials. They go down to the cafeteria. They do the hot lunch thing. The parents are learning the whole kindergarten routine. This is brilliant. The parents are making the kindergarten a setting in their mesosystem, a setting where they now are familiar and they have been given a role. Okay, sometime in the next day or two or three, your job, parents, is to bring your kindergartner to school and orient your kindergartner. So the parents study this because they've got to teach their child, and the teacher will be there for support. Then the parents bring the kid into the new setting. The parents introduce the child to the teacher. The parents show the child where her stuff is going to go. The parents describe the routine. They play at the art table with the kid. They take the kid through the hot lunch line. They introduce the child to this new setting of the school as a place where they are familiar, where they already know what's going on. And they, rather than the teacher, do the orientation. The teacher gets to step back, observe. She learns about the parents and their communication style. But she's able to be not directly, come child, do this, here's what you've got to learn, and the kid is totally overwhelmed. She gets to say, if you have any questions, ask me. And the kid gets to approach the teacher at the child's own pace, with the parents there to support her. So the kids come in to the setting. They meet the teacher when they're ready to, which may be half an hour in, to actually start a conversation. And some kids come in and they, you know, teacher, come in. I don't know your name. I don't care your name is. Teacher, I want to show you this. Here's what I brought. And other kids come in and they would rather not interact with the teacher for several months. But at least it's easier for them to do that interacting if the parents are there. The parents have told them the teacher's name. The parents are obviously okay with this process. And they're there to support the kid. And then the parents fade. And what happened in that school was immediately the first day of school, the first week of school, the second week of school, problems for kindergartners. Because he created a comfortable setting for them. And I told him several years ago that, you know, hey, I've got this book that explains why all that worked, or actually takes what works and adds fancy labels to it, which is what most theories do. Contrast that with a local elementary school that I will not name publicly, which sends instructions to the parents about drop off the first day of school. Drop your kid. Do not come in the building. This seems to me to be totally cruel. I really want to go watch someday because maybe it works just fine. But their problem is that they have so much problem with the parents being able to leave and the kids being upset when the parents leave that they would rather have the upset happen. And I anticipate that what they get is a whole bunch of kids who are totally petrified coming in the door. And I'd like to know how they handle that entrance as the kids are coming in the door. I just want to see it. But it's a very different approach. Yeah. So you spent this time. We'll do the transfer. I've got mom. Okay, it's okay now. I can let go, but I can't put my feet on the floor and be by myself. And that's typical for kids. You know, you don't want to be there all by yourself. And it's hard. I'm curious too about this other school and what happens there with kids. What you'll see is that many of the hypotheses that Bronfenbrenner presents are hypotheses about how to make entrance into new settings easier, and then because it's easier, how to make the engagement in the activities in these settings more developmentally facilitating. So what he's talking about is how to get from the microsystem in one setting, which may be quite familiar, to the microsystem in another setting, making that new setting part of your mesosystem and becoming comfortable in it. And you'll see there are a variety of ways in which he proposes that that happens. For example, if the role demands in the different settings are compatible. So if when you go from one setting to another, you're stepping into a new role, perhaps, but the demands in those two roles in the two settings are compatible, it's easier for you to enter in the new setting. It helps if the microsystem in each, the roles, the activities, the dyadic relationships, encourage the development of mutual trust. So what you want to have happen is that any two settings are characterized by a relationship of trust. What happens in one is supported by what happens in the other. And people in one setting support what you do in the other setting. You want positive orientation. You want them to think the other setting is good for you. And you want them to have some similar goals for you, the different settings. And you want all of them to involve the child or the developing person developing more power in each of the settings. That's fundamental to development. Now, take the situation where the home school mesosystem is one where parents have prepared the kid to go to school for years. They've talked about it. Hey, you're going to school. We've got to get you ready for that. We're going to help you become literate. We're going to read lots of books to you. We're going to have you draw when you're 2 and 3 and 4. And you can do more of this when you get to school. And that'll be fun because when you get to school, you can do this even more and you can do it with other kids. And you're really going to like school. And your teacher's going to be great. And won't it be fun not to have mommy in your face all the time, but have a teacher who knows a lot more than mommy, and school is a really great place, and you're going to have so much fun there, and we're going to be so happy when you come home from school every day and tell us everything that you've learned. We want you to bring pictures and all those sorts of things. And when you get to school now, remember that you're supposed to ask lots of questions, make sure you understand everything. That's positive attitude from home to school. It's positive attitude. It's goal consensus. We want you to learn the things that they want you to learn in school. We're prepared for that. Your teacher is wonderful, will be wonderful. We don't even know who she is, but she's going to be wonderful. And we're going to like her, and we're going to come to school. And I wish I could go to kindergarten again, too. All that positive stuff. Think about the kid who comes out of a home like that and goes into kindergarten. Wow, okay. I'm really looking forward to this. This is the kid who wants to go to 4. Because you've talked it up so much and is disappointed that they have to spend another year in preschool. They go to kindergarten, they love it, they're there, they're having a great time. Contrast that with the home where parents say, if you behave like that in school, you're going to be in deep doo-doo. And now we're not going to read because they'll teach you to do that in school, but you know, reading's not terribly important. I actually heard a member of my extended family tell his wife that she was spending much too much time reading to their son. There are times when you hate your family. But he was concerned, and he said so in front of the kids, that you spend much too much time reading, you're going to turn the kid into a sissy. People who like to read a lot are sissies. Our families are not all perfect, and this was my extended family, my immediate family. And what message did the kid get about reading? Okay. Reading will turn you into a sissy. Okay. The kid is now a grown-up. When was the last time you read a book? I don't know, but I don't give them to him for Christmas. I guess I'm abetting this. I should send him books. Anyway, the connection between home and school is not supportive. There were threats about, you're going to get into trouble. Keep your mouth shut when you get to school. Don't make a nuisance of yourself. to the teacher. You know, teachers like kids who are quiet. You know, teachers want you to ask questions. So what you get in some families is they're not positively oriented towards school, and the kid doesn't get goal consensus and role compatibility. School wants you to read. Family wants you to not be a sissy. You got to be tough. You got to stand up for yourself. School wants you to be collaborative. You got to not sit around all the time. School wants you to sit around. I'm not going there. You get the point. The settings can have either a lot of goal consensus, a lot of positive attitude, a lot of role compatibility, and that makes it much easier for the kid to go into school and engage and be successful. And the setting can be negative about the next setting that you're going into, and that makes it difficult to go in and engage there. They have not provided the kinds of skills and attitudes that are going to be useful in the new setting. Brunton-Brenner assumes that lots of structurally different settings are useful to you. In other words, if your mesosystem is rich, because there are lots of settings, and if there's a variety, if the microsystems in each are different, you have different roles and activities. So instead of being at home all of your childhood until you go to school, it might be useful if you're in your home and other people's homes, and maybe Sunday school, and maybe whatever else you want to get the kid involved in. So the child has the opportunity to be engaged in different kinds of activities with different kinds of people. Because as you do that, you're creating a child with more skills, better understanding of the world, more flexibility, more ability to move into a new setting and figure out what's going on because the child has had practice in doing that. It helps if there are joint activities and primary dyads in those different settings. So visiting your relatives, visiting your neighbors, sharing meals in your parents' friends' homes, play groups, all of those sorts of things, Brunton-Brenner says, are useful. They provide you the skills that you're going to need to take into new settings. And it helps if you're around a lot of people who have more skill than you do, that you can learn from. Brunton-Brenner suggests that it helps if these different settings represent different cultures. So you learn that people do things differently. They're not all the same. They have different furnishings, they have different food, they have different traditions, they have different beliefs, they have different ways of speaking. That gives you a more valid view of the kind of world that you live in. So you're not blown away when you walk into some place where there are people who are different than you are. It helps if there have been a lot of transcontextual dyads. Brunton-Brenner's big on transcontextual dyads, particularly if they're with people you have primary dyadic relationships with. So you have a network of friends. You have a network of relatives and people who like you in those different settings. All of those characteristics, all of those experiences, make it likely that you have the ability to move into a new setting and engage in it. That one's debatable. And you might want to raise questions about that one. But he puts those together and says some cultures encourage transcontextual dyads more than others. Some families, for example, are likely to take kids with them wherever they go. They're likely to send siblings together into new settings. They're likely to engage you with aunts and uncles, with neighbors. They have an open attitude toward including other people, and they're likely to send you off as a child with other families, maybe with siblings. So they're creating the opportunity for you to have those transcontextual dyads, and in doing that, they make it more likely that you will be able to go into a variety of settings, maybe experience things that you wouldn't get otherwise. They're encouraging your participation in different settings with different people. And some of our families don't do that. We don't encourage it. These, you'll see, overlap in different ways. And he wants you to have the transcontextual dyads across different settings. So you go not just to one other setting with a particular person, but maybe to four or five other settings. And he wants the next three or four all involve having supplemental links, and my watch is slow, and you're telling me by your body language that I should look at that clock, and I just did, and I will see you on Monday. Bring your questions about the mesosystem hypotheses and examples on Monday.